Welcome to episode 90 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my returning guest is Gus Lanzetta. He's a writer and podcaster who lives in São Paulo, Brazil.
Oh, I love that pronunciation. That took effort. I respect that. I appreciate that. And I love that I am right here in my favorite moment of the podcast. It's when that nice intro song is fading out. It's so chill. That song, you picked a great song.
Our subject for today is the Danish action comedy Riders of Justice, starring Mads Mikkelsen. Did you know that the proper pronunciation is Mads Mikkelsen?
I am heartbroken by that news that you brought me, Jesse, and it reminds me of a very frustrating time in my life. I went to the Netherlands for a couple weeks, and I was there, and I was trying to learn the pronunciation of certain words and trying to communicate. They mostly speak English there. It was fine. But, you know, you learn some words and some pronunciations, and then I immediately took a train to Berlin, where the words spell the same are pronounced very differently. And I was very frustrated, and thus we come to the Mads. And I am frustrated yet again. But hey, it's sometimes when we say the Mads, it doesn't mean his name, it means his vibe.
Yeah, for sure. He doesn't mind being called Mads, because that's pretty cool.
Because a man named Mads would not mind. He vibes like that. Like, who is more likable than him? He's so likable that he's the guy they cast in the place of Johnny Depp when they had to get rid of Johnny Depp from those knockoff Harry Potter movies.
Riders of Justice, directed by Anders Thomas Jensen. In my notes, after finishing watching this movie, I wrote, "Men will literally avenge their wife's death by killing an Aryan biker gang instead of going to therapy."
Well, yeah, it is literally what this movie is about. I was in the real kick of like trying to put together and pull apart these revenge movies during the pandemic, because there's this weird fascination towards them, because I am a huge fan of the John Wick franchise, which really sparked a new life into the genre. And I thought that when I found Blue Ruin, a great American movie, I had found that, oh, this is the revenge movie that deconstructs the revenge movies. And then Carly from a friend of the podcast Hit Factory, said, oh, do you watch Riders of Justice? And I was like, oh no, I watched the trailer for that, never watched the movie. And I was like, oh no, this is also a great deconstruction of the revenge movie while being a revenge movie. So this pairs up really nicely.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I was instantly interested in a movie that made the top 10 films of the year list for both Will Meneker and Lights, Camera, Jackson.
Yeah, Will Meneker, famously inventor of movie mindset. Right. Yeah. The science that studies are the way we connect to movies in such ways as Dudes Rock and other feelings.
Mm-hmm. It was sold as an action thriller. It's kind of false advertising. I guess they had to do whatever they could do to make some money.
I don't know how Danish movie works, but this is probably paid for by taxes because they have like welfare state there and things work. But like this was probably like, yeah, someone had, oh, we have a grant here that will pay for the movie. And Mads is famous, and he probably just like charmed some woman into giving them money and like over wine, and it was all done. But I don't know if it was a necessity of marketing, but I think it works. I think that the same as Blue Ruin, if you watch the trailer for that, it will not give away what it is. It will sell you on like, oh, this is another revenge thriller. I think it is necessary for the movie. I think it's really good for the movie that it sells itself as what it isn't.
When you look at the poster for Riders of Justice and you watch the trailer, you're expecting the big payback kind of movie with, you know, guys laying waste to the villains and getting revenge. That's kind of what this movie is about. But what's really going on here is that it's a movie that's a meditation on many things, including grief, toxic masculinity, the role that coincidence and circumstance and fate play in our lives, the lack of control that we have over the things that happen to us in our lives, the way that we try to make sense of things that cannot be understood.
How your brain needs and will be kept healthy by human connection, right? That at the end of the day, the reason to stay sane is to be able to enjoy life with other people, and that what will make you sane is enjoying life with other people. But yeah, like when I went to watch it, I didn't know the exact plot. But again, it was recommended by me as, you know, like, hey, you like revenge movies that are kind of like telling you that revenge is not good. So I knew that was going to be a twist, so to speak. But it was so fun to watch it and see what it was and how many things, as you said, it approaches. Like, it is able to bring in, like, surveillance state, the use of technology and machine learning in surveillance, and the limitations of that, and how eager we are to form narratives in our minds to frame ourselves as the heroes of our journeys, and how that just doesn't apply to reality. You know, reality is a bunch of things happening, and some of them coincidentally and some of them in parallel, and nothing is black or white, and those are messages that we've seen over and over, but the way this movie brings them forth is so good. And the way it casts our leading man Mass, or Mads as you will, is good, because he is a soldier returning home, but he is also our good old boy Mads, you know, the actor coming home. You know, he's giving his Hollywood big name and big, you know, image, and to this local production. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the two for them, one for me kind of thing. I felt that it was kind of like, hey guys, I'm back. I don't know his relationship to the director and the other people, but it kind of felt like of, oh hey, I got all this Hollywood attention on me, so now we can do like something really fun here that's really gonna get a lot of attention, so we can use me as the launching pad for something really cool here.
What I love about him is that he's managed to sort of put Danish film on the map, leveraging his celebrity. He works all the time in Denmark. If we think that we see a lot of him here, they see even more of him there. His international persona is generally as a villain, but in Denmark, he's a guy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something we talked about before we started recording, is that how... If you don't watch non-American films for a while, you'll forget that people's faces are not their personality, and that it is okay to cast people. like in real life, it doesn't, like, oh, that round faced guy with the big eyes is not nice. Yes, he's not nice. People's faces do not give away all of their character. and people with sharp lines on their facial features are not always villains, and all of those things. So this movie kind of like having Mads as, you know, it kind of uses him as his face of like, just, hey Mads, you with a beard? It's scary. Oh, we go with that. And then, but it also, all the other people are like, just, hey, these are people. They look like people. and they get to be them and complex characters. So it's a nice breathing from, you know, from the first time I saw him, which was Casino Royale, where I think a lot of people first saw him in that. And it's like, oh, okay. The only Germanic person with very, you know, straight lines in his face is the villain, and our, you know, brutish blonde man is the one who can save us, and Ava Green is there. I will just clap for that.
He was already a popular actor in his native Denmark. Fascinatingly, he was originally a dancer. He only pivoted to acting when he turned 30.
He's a marvelous dancer. But that's something I think a lot of Americans don't realize, is that most of the time when you see a non-American actor in a film with a big role, that means he has to be the Tom Cruise of his country to be able to have like three lines in an American movie. You know, like the crossover, like the amount of energy you need to cross over is like in physics of like you need a certain amount of energy to like bring water up to its boiling point. But then to make the jump from liquid to gas, it takes an extra bit of amount of energy than just like going up the degrees. It's the same thing of like you have to be really famous and like things have really aligned. And you have to know the certain people and your people, your agents and managers have to be the right people. And then when the moon is the right distance from the earth, you can boom, and then you get like something like Casino Royale for you, and then you can maybe spin that into some other roles. But a lot of the times these people will get one role in Hollywood and then go back home. It's like, hey, I had that one Hollywood role.
Did you ever see the Pusher films by Nicholas Winding Refn?
No, I had them on my hard drive for the longest time. And I remember when Netflix started doing streaming, they had all the Pusher films. And I had them on my queue, but I never... Aren't there like five of those films? It's like a bunch of those films, right?
Well, there's an official trilogy anyway. Oh, okay. They may have made some since then, maybe direct-to-video in Denmark. I don't know VOD works in Denmark.
This is
but
how
he was in the
I
second
am.
And third films. In
could
the
have sworn
trilogy.
Those movies were Russian.
Yeah. They feel very Russian because it's, you know, Mads is a sort of Copenhagen skinhead criminal in the second film.
Again, did not know Copenhagen was in Denmark. It's just literally for us here, Jesse, on the south of the world, it's just the cold guys over there. It's the cold countries. We don't differentiate.
You can't really hear the difference between a Finnish accent and a Danish accent.
You know? It's just what food does it sound like he's choking on when he talks? Like Danish is more of like a soft boiled egg. German is more of like a dry bread.
In terms of the achievements that Danish cinema has made in the last 20 or so years, Mikkelsen has been one of the main actors that a lot of people use, and he works all the time. You compared him off air to the Argentine actor Ricardo Darín, who is in pretty much every single Argentine film.
Yes, that is a running joke here in Brazil. I don't know, probably in Argentina as well, that apparently he's in every movie. And I was like organizing my movie collection a few weeks ago, and I was like realizing that like I have maybe like three Argentinian films on my server, but like all of them star Ricardo. He's not just in those movies, he stars in those movies. But I think the biggest difference is that Ricardo has a like kind puppy eyes, and Mads has the eyes of a wolf.
Yeah. And this is his wolfiest performance yet in ways in Riders of Justice. He's hidden basically behind this gigantic beard, which I presume is a real beard. It looks he grew out a huge beard.
No Danish actor would allow just glue on his face with fake. No, the Danes would never. No, yeah. Like I think that's his real beard. And I think it's a great movie to watch like now, because we've all grown out our pandemic beards at some point. We've shaved them off already, but we know, like we can look at that and go like, I know how to feel. That beard carries feelings. there's a lot of angst and sadness in that beard.
Well, this is something I was thinking when I was watching the movie, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about it, because you live in Brazil, one of the hardest hit countries in the world in terms of the coronavirus. Like, it was literally dangerous for you to be outside, more so than most other countries, because of how your government handled the pandemic.
Yes.
I think that a movie like Riders of Justice really resonated in the coronavirus era. I presume the vast majority of people around the world watched it on demand because they couldn't go see it in the theater. But the movie really hits home in a couple of ways in terms of vengeance, you know, the appeal of a movie about wanting revenge for what has happened to you, the idea of trying to make sense of things that don't make sense and coming up with a plan to fight based on your understanding of what led up to this, and gigantic pandemic beards.
Yes. I think the greatest asset of this movie for me is how it delves into the why. right? It the reason something happens, or the lack of. Because Blue Ruin, which I also love and mentioned before, still has a reason. Like, oh, this happened for a reason. This crime you want to avenge happened for a reason. And you know what it is. It is clear. And you will avenge it. You might find new details about it. But it's still, the point is that it doesn't matter that you know why. The revenge itself will not fulfill anything. Will not be a final. Right, but this even goes further of like something that is so personal to you, a personal, such a loss, such a violent extrication of life from your life, can be accidental and for nothing, right? And the fact that our brains are such narrative starved machines that will. That they need the narrative to be soothed will create a narrative to soothe the pain. And it has consequences when you act upon those narratives.
In the movie, Mads is playing a man who is stationed in Afghanistan. I presume he's in the Danish army. They must have had some form of military presence there.
Yeah, those pushovers over there, they'll do anything the European Union tells them to do. Like, yeah, okay, we'll support the war. I don't care. No one knows what the country is, what we do.
But the idea is that he's there to protect his way of life. And while he's stationed in... Well, I mean, this is what military guys believe. Anyway.
Well, yeah, but it's better that he's Danish than American in this point. Because like it is easier to see the artificiality of that argument, I think, with a Danish guy than an American guy.
This weekend, for instance, Top Gun Maverick opened, and all these people are talking about how it's military propaganda. And, you know, it's hard to for an international audience to get sort of jingoistic about seeing a Danish army man.
Yeah. I think because we don't get because all we get is American military propaganda. So when you point it out, people go like, well, no, it's just the normal thing. It's like, no, it's because all the other normal things are also propaganda. But then it's like we don't see anything going like the Danish people are proud and strong and we need to fight to keep Danish, you know, I don't know. Like even when we talk about Europe in the conflict you know, the way we try to pretend it wasn't right before the Ukrainian invasion of like, oh no, Europe is done with the whole invading and separating of states. It is not, you know, Serbia, Montenegro, all of that stuff is all of those states are in a constant state of flux. But I feel like Denmark has kind of been okay. For a long time. It's not even like in the level of a Poland of like, oh, it's you know, the communists that wanted it and the Nazis wanted it. And no, like nobody wanted Denmark. They're fine. They're chill. They don't grow anything as far as I know. They don't make watches like the Swiss do or keep everyone's gold hidden. And, you know, they're just there. I'm sorry, the gold is Switzerland. I was talking about it on Twitter yesterday that I don't know the difference between Sweden and Switzerland. And I got great anecdotes about how apparently Switzerland is like the gold and chocolate people. And Swedes are people who will not invite you over to eat because someone posted like two exchanges of people on Tumblr going like, oh, when I was a kid and I was in Sweden, like a friend of mine said, hold on, I'll be right back. And then when I went to look, he was having breakfast with his family. And then this other... this other segment was like, oh, hey, I was at my friend's house in Sweden and his mom was like, come over, have dinner to the kid. And like just left him waiting while the kid had dinner. And it was like, if you weren't fed by your family, we will surely not feed you. How does a community like that become a nation and a state? I don't know. But hey, they did.
Riders of Justice was put out by a company called Nordisk Film, which is, as I discovered, one of the oldest surviving film production companies in the world. It's the same age as Pathé and Gaumont.
Wow. But
Pathé and Gaumont weren't running as companies periodically in the ensuing
right,
years.
Right, yeah, not continually all throughout.
Yeah, whereas Nordisk Film, founded in 1906, has never stopped making movies.
Again, because Denmark has never seen any trouble. No one goes there. Nothing happened to them. They could keep going just as usual. A nice little anecdote here. I actually watched the original John Wick in a Pathé movie theater in the Netherlands.
Oh, really?
Yes. I escaped the Rijksmuseum. I was like, this is enough art for now. This is enough high art for now. I want new cool art, and I went to the movie theater nearby.
And I also found out that before the advent of sound, a great deal of silent cinema came from Denmark.
Yeah, because we didn't have to hear their weirdly glottal language.
When sound came, then the Danes started making films specific for the local market.
Yeah, the only people who would tolerate that sound. This movie was all people just like, are you drinking water while you do this?
Yeah. Yeah, there were times where I was getting distracted by the sound, the glottal sound of Danish people speaking.
Yeah, especially the tallest one of the guys on the Riders of Justice, the titular group of guys. Like, he has, like, he's great, and he has a great, like, deep voice, but he, like, my dude, like, I was ready for like a boiled egg to just pop out of his mouth. I was like, oh, this was, you know, in my throat. It's kind of hard to talk.
The director Andres Thomas Jensen has made 5 films with Mads Mikkelsen. He's a filmmaker, but he was also a very prolific screenwriter in the Danish sort of film boom that started in the 90s with Lars von Trier and Thomas Vinterberg. When Jensen and Mads Mikkelsen first met, before they started collaborating together artistically, they got into a fist fight,
which is incredible. An article that kind of told that story, and I maybe it was because maybe I was high on horse tranquilizers at the time. Maybe had something to do with it, but I could not follow the reason why the fist fight had started. I read that article. You sent me a link, and I was like, "But you still have not explained, Mads, why the fist fight started." It was like, "Oh, he was there, and then we were fist fighting, and then hey, you know, whatever. You know, he's a director, and he's very literal, and he wanted to do things this way. But if he wanted to talk about them literally, he couldn't. So he does movies about these other things. But he's really talking about these other things." And I was like, "Can we go back to the part where you punched him?"
Yeah.
World star.
This is a quote from Mads Mikkelsen. He said, "Andres in his younger days was very provocative, and I have a big mouth as well. We ended up in a fight. It was a party, and we just ended up fighting on the staircase. So that was the first time I met him."
See, there's no explanation. It was like, and I feel like, I don't remember what the title was for the article, but I feel like I was promised an explanation, and there was no explanation. But now... That's crafty of you, Jesse, as a podcast maker, that you brought this doubt into me, because now you're going to say, "But Gus, why does anything happen? Why did the fist fight happen? Why did the explosion on the train in the movie happen?"
Mikkelsen, continuing here, "A couple months later, he asked me to be in his film. I think the fight was kind of my audition. He's calmed down a lot."
This reminds me, actually now, this reminds me of a relationship I have with a friend of mine who's a director, and we met in high school. We had friends in common, and we would hang out at, like, you know, house parties and stuff like that. And we hated each other. Like, we hated everything about each other. And I remember, like, one time, like, we almost came to fist fights. We were both, like, I was fat and nerdy, and he was, like, skinny and lanky and nerdy. And so, like, I remember I made fun of his Nokia phone. He had one of those Nokia phones that opened up to have a split QWERTY keyboard. And I was like, "You fucking idiot, who buys that phone?" And I remember we would just, like, we just hate each other. And just eventually he needed someone annoying for something, and he was like, "I need someone annoying for something, and I thought of you." And I was like, "Ah, yes." And then from then on, we became great friends, and I've acted in a bunch of things he's done, and he directed a music video of mine, and we're great friends. But it's, hey, sometimes it does come from that great collaboration. Both of us thought the other was an asshole. And then we eventually realized that we were right, but that doesn't mean that we can't get along.
That's true. At least you know what you're getting into.
Yeah, it's like you end up realizing, like, oh, no, he is an asshole, but he's my kind of asshole.
Jeg beder om at finde alt, hvad jeg kan for rockergruppen Riders of Justice. Det er Emmentaler, vores face recognition ekspert. Den er så god til at finde ting. Er det noget, I kan, uden at ligge spores? I har fattet, det er det nemmeste for dig i verden.
Det er det nemmeste for mig i verden.
Gus, can you give the listener a general idea of the plot of Riders of Justice?
Yeah, so Mads, like you said, is a soldier fighting in Afghanistan, and he has a wife and a teenage daughter back in Denmark. They are at home waiting for him to return. He's asked to stay for another tour, so another few months in Afghanistan, and that frustrates his wife. And then she kind of like to make up for her daughter, she kind of goes like, oh, you can skip school today, we'll go grab some ice cream, blah blah blah. And so they do not follow their normal daily routines, and they take the train into the city. And when they're taking the train back to their suburbs and their home, there's an explosion on the train, and the wife dies, the daughter is wounded, and then Mads flies back home to find his daughter and to bury his wife. And then while they're both trying to cope with the loss of this woman, you know, the daughter is trying to find a reason, you know, so she has post-it cards all over trying to find what sequence of events led to this, and what decision could have she made to stop all of this from happening. While Mads is just angry and sullen and trying to figure out how to be a dad after being just like a soldier for so long. And they are approached by this other man who was in the train, who is a scientist studying, you know, data and data mining to create predictions. And he believes that he can figure out what led to the explosion. Thus, he creates the Riders of Justice, which is this group of nerds and researchers, plus Mads, who's the muscle of the group, because they eventually believe that they find that a neo-Nazi gang exploded a bomb on the train to kill a witness in an upcoming trial that would convict one of their own.
The biker gang called the Riders of Justice.
Oh yes, the Riders of Justice are the the Riders. I confused. But don't they name themselves something?
I can't remember. I think you're supposed to think that they are also the Riders of Justice in their own way.
Yes, it's kind of the duality of the title. Yes, so it worked on my brain. Yes, so the Riders of Justice are the biker neo-Nazi gang.
But the statistician who comes to Mads's home because he feels that he has a responsibility to tell this man that his wife, it was not an accident, that she
yes.
was,
and he
she
is,
was
is
caught in a, she was caught in a situation.
Yeah. And specifically he goes to Mads's house because he was sitting down, and when he saw the mother daughter, he stood up and gave her his seat. And so she died, and he lived, and so he has specific guilt about Mads' wife dying, because he thinks that, well, I also, you know, was part of the decision making that led to her death, because if she was standing up and I was sitting down, maybe I would have died and she would be living. And so that's why he goes straight to him.
The daughter and this guy named Otto, who's the statistician, they're kind of simpatico in many ways, because they're trying to piece together the order of events that led to this situation, the idea that there is no such thing as a coincidence, that everything, every act that we do is a chain reaction that leads to an ultimate situation.
Yes.
So the girl is wondering what's going on here, because her bike got stolen. She can't ride her bike to school because her bike's gone. Her mother's car breaks down, so that's why they take the train. And these are the things that the girl is fixated on, the idea that this thing that happened led to this thing that led to this thing that led to her mother's death. The statistician is also kind of thinking this way too, like in a whole separate world, like his whole thing is about trying to figure out probabilities of outcomes. And he thinks that the bomber was this guy who got off the train.
Yes.
That he remembers seeing a guy throw a full sandwich and drink into the garbage on his way off the train. And he thinks that's very unusual behavior.
I am totally the guy that watched too many thrillers and detective TV shows that would have jumped to the same conclusion as Otto. So I really identified with that. But, you know, in retrospect, it's so fun how the movie kind of hits you in the face in a few scenes with the thought process that should lead you to the conclusion of the movie, which is, no, stop. You're fooling yourself. You're making assumptions. Because the first time we are introduced to Otto's work is when he and a colleague are making a presentation to, like, this board that kind of... either investors or people from the board that decide if they're going to have keep the research grant that they have, and they're basically applying their findings to market research. So they go like, oh, so we correlated these kinds of purchases and the amount of money people make to what kind of cars they would purchase, and they go like, well, you needed an algorithm to tell you that rich people are going to buy a Volvo. And it's like, well, no, well, yes, because you assume that, but we actually proved it. So we actually proved the correlation, and they were like, well, yeah, but we can just assume it. And the narrative it already exists. We already know.
We don't need to give you all this money to tell us what we can already see on ourselves.
Exactly. So they have this scene that proves that shows you that we're going to go with our own assumptions. Doesn't matter what you tell us. And the numbers can either prove it or disprove it, but we already know what we know. And then later, when he goes into the daughter's room and sees the post-its and sees what she's trying to do, of like, what is the originating, like, what is the original sin? What is the one thing that made my mom die? Is it that my bike got stolen? Is it that my dad was not here to fix the car? What was it? What was it? Was it that I woke up late? Was it, what was it? And then he kind of goes in and goes and shows her, like, hey, neither of these things are starting points. So these things were already caused by their own other, pre-existing factors and conditions. And so it's an you can regress eternally, and you would, you know, go back to the Big Bang if you go through this. You will never find the root cause of anything, because everything is a root and everything is a leaf. It's not a tree.
Yeah, her bike was stolen because somebody else in the world wanted a blue bicycle.
Yes, this poor man wants to give his granddaughter a bike, and there's this man who sells stolen bikes near his house, and he really wants and his granddaughter really wants the bike of that specific color, and so the man puts out a call going, hey, if you can get a red bike, I can sell it, and then we go. So he kind of... And he kind of saves the daughter from that kind of obsessive thinking at that point, but then doesn't realize he's doing the same thing with this. No, we will find whoever did this and why they did this, and then we can go and we can have our revenge, and it will be fine.
All of these people are dealing with loss and grief and anger at what appears to be a godless universe. Like, there's a scene where they're at the funeral of the mother, and the woman who's leading the service is basically saying that, you know, there are things that we will just never understand, even if it's God's will. That doesn't really do much for us.
Yeah.
You know, like, we don't understand why this happened. You can drive yourself crazy trying to make sense of the randomness of actually being alive.
It's kind of that thing of like, if you're gonna look at bad things that happen and go, why me? Then you would have to look at all the other bad things that don't happen to you and go, why not me? You know, like, you get COVID and you go like, well, what about all the other diseases I did not catch? What about all the other times I did not catch COVID or things like that? And I think that it is also something that is good about the movie being Danish and not American, because it is, you know, the Danes, like most Europeans, are godless heathens, and thus they can look at the question without having to first bypass the whole God, Christian God thing, you know, that you would have to go, even in a modern Hollywood movie, you know, there's Christianity distilled in our water here, in our American, you know, as all of the Americas, there's, we grow up with some sort of Christian ideology in our worldview. And I think that what we see in the reality of these characters is much more of like this. No, it's just, you know, it's nature, things happen, and you can call it God or whatever, but it's like, yeah, you'll never really understand this. And what they are incapable of taking from that speech from the funeral is that when they go like, you cannot really understand this, you just have to live with this. This, meaning the death, includes the mourning. But they separate those two things. They think that the death is a fact and that is objective and not emotional in any way, and that their emotions that they are feeling are these pesky remnants that they need to just like shut away and get rid of, and not understand of, no, this is all part of that thing that you should be able to deal with peacefully, and you are now breaking the whole reality around you to not face it head on.
Mads Mikkelsen's character is a military man, and he's very stoic, and you can't really read what's going on with him. But the inner turmoil manifests itself throughout the movie in sudden acts of violence.
And throwing away of perfectly good food.
Oh, yeah.
Really, that's when you know that the man is over the edge. He makes this beautiful breakfast for him and his daughter, and when she won't eat it, he throws his breakfast away, too. And just, yeah, like, smokes a cigarette and drinks. Yeah. And it's like, no, you know, real people would have eaten that food. So that's how far gone that man is. He doesn't want those beautiful eggs.
He's so far gone, like, you know, the absence of his wife from his life brings up all these giant question marks about the way they live. For instance, they live in a farm, you know, in the countryside in Denmark. And the house that they live in is actually very small. And then there's this gigantic Death Star-sized barn outside the house.
And I love
it. It's like five times as big as their house.
And in a cliche, predictable revenge movie, there would be a backstory to that. I'm like, oh, that's where I keep my... I was always ready for this. This was going to happen. He was going to be a prepper or something. And... And we have one of the characters keeps asking about the shed, and you think there's going to be a backstory, but then it becomes a running joke that he's asking about the shed. But then it becomes an even more personal anecdote about the character that asks about the shed, that we become aware of a trauma of his that is related to a shed in his youth. And some abuse that went on in the shed, and it's just amazing when because not only does the movie zag when you think it's gonna zig, but it makes the zags so enjoyable for you as the audience.
Yeah, I was really digging it in the middle of the movie because Mads is Mr. Military, you know, precision. We see Mads actually instantly kill someone, as they're getting closer and closer to squaring off against this Aryan biker gang called the Riders of Justice. They go to the brother's house looking for the guy, and this middle-aged neo-Nazi basically pulls a gun on Mads, and Mads walks away, and then you just see the rage boiling over, and he just spins on his heels and walks right back into the house and just offs the guy.
Yeah. If you want to have an anti-imperialistic war reading on this movie, which you can if you want, like we want, so here we are. You can really read that scene of like, this man has been in Afghanistan doing just that. Like, he takes no disrespect. It doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter who those people are and what they did. If he knocks on a door and he gets disrespected, those people are going to, you know, be subject to his wrath. And that's what he has learned to do. And it has been, you know, well compensated by the state to do. And now he knows no other way to act.
And this is an issue that even comes up with his own daughter. I thought it was very funny in the scene because she has a boyfriend that Mads doesn't really know about. And he pops him off too. Like yeah. he punches him right out. Off
and
his,
it becomes a
motorbike.
Big deal. Like it does. Like in real life, if you punch another person, it is a big deal. It's not just something that goes like, oh, it's a one, whoa, and then it's like, oh, someone has an ice pack on their. It's like, no, it's a big deal. Like in my life, if I knew two people and one of them punched the other, it's like, that's going to be a big deal. And we're going to figure out if these people can be together in the same room ever again. Like, you don't. Yeah. No, don't punch people. And much less, do not punch a teenager if you're a middle-aged man. There's a whole other power, you know, dynamic there. And I love how the movie, like, really treats it as it is and contrasts it with the violence that not only is going to happen, but that it knows we want to happen. We as an audience have the bloodlust. We're there because we were promised Mads kicking ass. And now he does kick ass. But we are made to feel it in reality. It's like, oh, no, that's not what we meant, Mads. No, he's a kid. No, not him.
His daughter's really mad at him. And Mads says, was that your boyfriend? And she's like, well, I don't know.
Yeah, now,
maybe not
I don't know
now.
Anymore. Like, yeah.
now that my dad has punched the guy out, I could see why he might not want to date me.
Exactly. It's so perfect. And I love how he is. You can laugh at him because he's such an exaggerated version of this current teenage generation that is so much more in touch with their feelings and much more aware of like emotional and social issues that Mads was not aware at any age, much less mm-hmm. in his younger days. And so he's mm-hmm. kind of a character of that, but he's never, but his worldview per se is not invalidated because you can laugh at him at some points. And that's why I think it's very good that he's back at the final scene when they're all together at Christmas. Cause like, there's one point there. And I thought, I was like, maybe are they going to like pretend that, you know, he's you know, like, I don't know, wastable or whatever. He's disposable. I was like, oh no. Okay. Yeah. Is the kid. Yeah. You don't expect him to have done any more than he did or to put up with any more than he did. And it's great that he's here.
Yeah. And I laughed at the scene where they're making dinner for him when he comes home and he just apologizes. He's like, I shouldn't have hit you. I'm very sorry. And the kid's like, oh, no problem. And he's got this gigantic purple black guy.
Yes, yes. Well, yeah.
And then that scene turns into an intervention where, you know, he and Mads' daughter are just telling him that you've got problems and you have to talk to professionals.
Yeah.
You can't just get through this alone. Look at what you're doing to people around you.
Yeah. And Mads is there listening and all that character is must be thinking is like, I could have just walked away and shut the door. This is what I do. I would have yelled to anyone who talked to me this way. And he's having to realize that that's the only thing that he can't do right now is that he has to get through that, has to learn to deal with things by doing anything other than his first instinct, which is violence.
I also really liked the sort of the collection of misfits that was starting to add up throughout this movie.
Yeah.
If you look at the poster for Riders of Justice, it's a stark photo of military man Mads. But when you watch the movie, he's with all these nerds, like these middle-aged, nerdy computer guys. And there's that really amazing character that comes in later in the movie named Emmenthal.
Yes.
who's like this, he looks like Timothy Spall or something. Like he's a really, really
he's great.
Chunky computer nerd who's like totally cut off from having a social life and he's full of rage he's really, really he really wants revenge on this biker gang.
Yes.
He knows what they're capable of and he really wants to do something about it. When he finds himself finally in a position to be able to enact revenge, he can't do it because he's cowardly.
Yeah, he's someone who's clearly been bullied his whole life and now sees this as the chance of like, this is me getting back at all the bullies, right? Because these guys, these neo-Nazi guys are the uber bullies of all. And if we if we get revenge on them for killing this guy's wife, we also, you know, this is revenge for a bunch of us, right? But I like how the movie is able to let itself have humor with those characters as well. Because when we are introduced to him, Otto and the other statistician decide that the best way to be let into his house is taking a pizza with them to him. And then we cut to inside of the house and he's like, I don't want any part of this. You can take your pizza. You already ate the pizza. And I was like, you gotta have that joke. It's like, and also, if I was that guy in that position, I would only yell, you can take your pizza with you, after I had already ate the pizza. I was not going to lose from pizza over this.
There's a good laugh where he's looking at them on the video intercom, and he's like, I'm not letting you in. And they're like, we brought a pizza, and they hold up the pizza, and then he goes, and like buzzes them.
Exactly. And also, I like that his character is very mad at something that I could really relate to. He's asked to do his work at someone else's computer that he feels is inferior to his. And I was like, ugh. I hate using someone else's keyboard. Like, it's like, this is not as good as my keyboard. This is not set up the way I like it. This is not it. And so I could completely relate to like this scene, which is supposed to be like, oh, the gang is getting together and they're going to be in the headquarters, you know, giving him the intel. It's like, no, what? You only have like a core two duel on this? Like, I can't do this. I'm this much. This sucks. No, I want a computer.
Denmark's doing something that you just don't get from American movies like this. Like a vengeance film from America is more of a Death Wish model of, you know, the vigilante and maybe a vigilante and their crew getting together to enact vengeance.
It can't go too far in questioning the concept of vengeance when the concept of vengeance is part of your policy. the defense policy and the international policies of the United States are based on the fact that vengeance does have moral value of, you know, if they back away from that, they do not only invalidate any argument they may have for future endeavors they want to pursue in the killing of people business, which makes them so much money, but they also invalidate this narrative that they use to keep people in line of, these people are fucking heroes. Every war we fought was fucking just. Right? Mm-hmm. And so if they lose that, then boom, then how do they recruit people? How do they get back that morale? Like, that is something we see even from certain progressive leaning types all the time, of like, the one thing they will not budge on is like, hey Ben, but I respect our troops. It's like, I don't think you should. I do not respect American troops at all. I don't respect Brazilian troops at all as well. And we make fun of them all the time here. And it's so fun. And you should. And you should demoralize military people. And you should not let them get away because, oh, you know, it's not them who make the decisions. Yes, but they execute them, and they are part of a problem. And so the same way we say, you know, cops are pigs, these fucking guys are green pigs. And so play Angry Birds. You get to kill green pigs with that. Also, on a side note, really addicted to Angry Birds too. I'm really been playing that a lot. Like, my girlfriend got me a tablet for my birthday, and like, I've just been playing every night before I go to sleep. I play so much Angry Birds too. Just help me.
You have military man Mads Mikkelsen with a computer programmer guy, a statistician who has a withered arm, and then this nerdy, tall statistician guy who's like even older than the rest of them, who, you know, admits freely to having like a whole history of psychological problems. These are the guys going up against this Aryan army. And I got to say, there was a scene in the movie where the bad guys are all sitting around and they figured out where Emmenthal lives. Like, they've managed to put it together. When they said that they had figured out Emmenthal's address, and when they figured out that Otto was this guy who had a withered arm, and they sort of thought of these guys as easy pickings, But at the same time, I was actually worried for the characters.
Yes.
Like, I was actually scared that they were going to get murdered by these guys.
Yeah. When
and I don't usually feel that way when I watch movies. Like, I don't be like, oh, God, they're going to kill Emmenthal.
Yeah, no, because the movie is really grounded up to that point. And it makes you really understand the fragility of those people because they feel like real people. The only person that doesn't feel like a real person is Mads's character because he's supposed to feel like that. He's supposed to feel like the hero they are projecting onto him, like the stern father figure that his daughter is projecting onto him. And the movie's about us also, you know, breaking down that projection and realizing, no, just a man. Maybe the amount of times he gets shot in that last scene and survives kind of doesn't work with the whole motto of the film, but still, I'll give him that because it works. And also, I want to, like now that we're talking about the neo-Nazis, I just want to shout out the performance of the main villain, who I already loved in Atomic Blonde, Roland Möller. I don't know what the O with the line through is, but he was also in Atomic Blonde, directed by one of the directors of John Wick, and he's just great as a villain. He's so good.
Yeah.
And his last line in this movie is so good to, like, kind of put another one of many, many bows on this nice little gift of a movie, which is, what did we ever do to you?
Yeah.
Because, again, yeah. These guys are neo-Nazis. You don't care if they die. But, again, he's just trying to figure it out. Like, what? Like, What is this train coming over me? Like, why? What did you pick me?
The other thing that I have to commend this film is that it's, there's a lot of tone shifts in this movie. And this is something that I'm sensitive to a lot when I watch movies, is when they try to shift gears and try to have it both ways to, you know, be a very, very sad and sweet movie and to be a violent action movie, it's hard to be able to manage those gear changes without seeming like you're whipping the audience around needlessly.
Yeah.
In this movie, it worked for me. Like I thought that they segued away from the sort of the tragedy and the sadness of the beginning of the movie into the comedy that sort of starts to take center stage in the middle of the film. It didn't bug me. Sometimes I get annoyed when a movie changes to a different kind of movie 20 minutes later.
I feel that way whenever I watch American movies, that like they kind of only know how to do one tone at a time, and that when you watch non-American movies, they're much more adept at just making something naturalistic, which is life has many tones all of the time. So, I remember when I started watching, like Korean movies like Memories of Murder, where you have funny moments during this harrowing investigation of, this policeman trying to figure out who's killing these girls. But, you have moments of like release and of catharsis. And this movie does that well enough because it feels naturalistic. You feel like you're living that whole process through with those people, and it has kind of a pandemic feel because they eventually all go to the farmhouse and kind of are living there together while they plot out their revenge, and there's the character that becomes the au pair of the family.
Yes.
I love his arc there, from going from the gimp with no lines on the scene, who would have been forgotten in any other movie, especially an American movie. It would have been himself a gag, like in a bad tone shift in an American movie. But in this movie, it's like, well, we can't leave him there. And if we're going to take him with us, we're going to talk to him and we're going to figure out what happened and why he was there. And he's going to lead us to figure out, this guy is a bad guy, but he's not responsible for what you think he is.
He's a victim of sex trafficking. And at the beginning of the movie, he almost seems like a quick aside to just show that these bad guys are deviants, that they've got a rent boy tied up in the house. They wind up keeping him on their team and they wind up sort of keeping him around, but they're not exploiting him. There's a strange scene where the kid asks whether or not they want to, you know, if they want to sexually assault him to help them get some sleep, you know, because that's the horrible life that this guy's been leading so far. It's like, do you need a sleep aid? Do you want to fuck me in the ass before you go to bed? And they're like, no.
No, yeah, we'll not do that to you. Yeah.
It's a tone that you don't expect from a movie to sort of to introduce a character who seems to be a sort of punchline, and then to humanize that person, and to also show that not all people are exploitative in this world.
Yeah, and also does a very good thing that American movies knew how to do, which is it illustrates something of like, hey, there is sex trafficking and xenophobia and problems related to immigration in Europe as well. We are not here to lecture you about this. This is just a thing from reality we picked up and put in this movie, and we will move along because you're an adult and you can think about that on your own time. So I think that it's very good, you know, that it kind of, it's, again, it adds to the naturalistic portrayal of this modern day Denmark. And really modern day Europe is very limited in how we see it in movies a lot of the times, because a lot of European movies are very, very, very microcosmic. And movies made outside of Europe that mention Europe just do it because they need a place with a blue hue to film something.
Yeah.
It's like the Bourne trilogy. Yeah. And so it was nice to go like, oh, hey, remember all those geopolitical problems also happening right here.
I was not expecting the light touch that this movie winds up having. It certainly does deliver the goods. Like, there is some major ownage in this film and some very, very satisfying kills.
But they are delivered in a brutal way. Like, they have weight. They're, you know, the gore is gory and the deaths, like, you kind of, in a lot of those scenes, you're put on the perspective of the nerds that kind of, because they kind of are surrogates for the audience in the cheering of the violence until it becomes questionable. And so you're kind of with them and you kind of go, yeah. Oh, man, maybe that was too much, but hey, yeah, nice. You know, you're with the nerd. At the end of the day, if it doesn't matter who you are watching this movie, you're more of a nerd than whatever that character Mads is playing is.
By the end of the movie, this ragtag group of people that were all united and joined by the blowback of the situation have come together and become a sort of family.
Yeah, they really do. And I think the most important part of that narrative arc for me, like I feel, is that it kind of doesn't give us an easy answer of how these characters go through that and get over, you know, the process of mourning and accepting what happened with their lives and accepting what they did afterwards as wrong, but also they were neo-Nazis. So what are you going to do? but it's kind of like they do what they can and with the people they have around, you know, they become a group because they are who they have. You know, and it's something that we already see during the movie between Otto and his other two scientist friends. You see Otto being this very, you know, caring and supportive guy to his friends, and he kind of brings that to the bigger group that includes Mads, his daughter, and the au pair. And it's good. It's good because, like you said, these are misfits. It doesn't paint a perfect family picture at the end, but it paints a scene that works. It's satisfying you. It's narratively satisfying, and you go like, okay, I see how this is a conclusion to that chapter of their lives, and maybe this can work. And it's as feel good as an ending anything like this could have.
Yeah, it's the riskiness of a film like this I appreciate. Like that it starts off with like a train bombing, turns into this weird comedy about nerds going against an Aryan biker gang, and then finally we've got Mads Mikkelsen in a Christmas sweater
yeah.
and Emmenthal playing the French horn.
Exactly. And they all, you know, get him through it, you know. It's just so good. It's like, yeah. Oh, man. This movie's so good. I hadn't thought about how wholesome that ending was until now. But man, it's you see, and that's something I think that maybe benefits this kinds of movies in this streaming and on-demand era, is that this kind of movie, with the low barrier to entry of you know, the platforms we have now, is kind of a movie that you don't have to describe a lot of, because it does so much, and you can kind of just go, please, just watch it. You know, you can go to a friend, just watch it, you're going to like it, trust me. Because all they have to do is carve out a couple of hours on their sofa, and they can watch this. And not to diminish the movie at all, but, you know, it certainly benefits from that people can go in not blind, because, you know, you can listen to this episode we just did and not have watched it, and go and watch it and, you know, and have a great experience. It doesn't need to surprise you to be a great addition to your life, but it just, you need to ride the ride, man. You need to ride with the Riders of Justice to know what it feels like to go through all these emotions like that. This movie makes a very important point, which is killing Nazis is not as bad as killing people, which is very important for us to understand. That's why it can redeem its characters at the end, and they can have Christmas at home, because in the end, all they did was kill some Nazis.
Gus, you're a gigantic Fast and Furious aficionado, and I really do want to talk to you about the latest developments in the Fast saga.
Yeah, it's. I'm sorry to have to come here and maybe deliver this news to people that don't know. Propelling Vin Diesel has now just been taking people hostage to make these movies. Like, listen, Jesse. These movies were about family. And this is not what family is about. This is what the Manson family was about. Vin Diesel has totally gone off the rails, even more than that time where he had Jason Statham's character, who killed Han, back into the family fold, invited to the barbecue. God damn it. Even though that barbecue was on a skyscraper, so it doesn't count. But so what happened is they're filming Fast X again, completely ignoring Jesse's title, which was much better, which was Fasten Your Seatbelts. And they're splitting it into two movies, apparently just called Fast X Part 1 and 2. Again, just throwing away... They had it, Jesse. 11 movies. They could have done the Ocean's 11 crossover. It was right there. And they didn't. They threw it all away. But again, we let that slide. Because why? Because Justin Lin was back. Lin directed Fast 9. And he was going to come back and finish the last trilogy. 9, 10, 11. He was back. And then Vin Diesel published a video in the second day of shooting, and that man looked distraught. Just like everything was taken from him. His dreams. And he brought Han back with him. He does not forget. And, you know, he had a blog a long time ago called You Offend Me, You Offend My Family. And that man means it. And 2 days into production, he was like, I am out! And all of the tinseltown trades are telling it like it is. They're saying Vin Diesel is acting childish, going late on set, trying to, like, act like he's, you know, queen of the ball and owns everything, king of the castle, blah blah blah. He's not. He's part of a family. He was for many years the stewardess of that family. He was the patriarch of that family. But a family is not an autocracy. It's not a one man leads for his will. He leads to the good of the family, and he's not doing that. And so everyone that shows up on that set seems very, very uncomfortable, except Jason Momoa. Jason Momoa was pretty chill in his video with Vin. But again, he alienated The Rock, who brought some freshness, some more family energy with his daughter and the whole interplay with him. Again, he has alienated the best parts of that franchise. He brought in Helen Mirren. You know, treasure she is. But I am very, very distraught. Like I told you on Twitter, I feel like my parents are getting divorced all over again. it feels like a bad breakup, and I hate to see it end this way. I cannot have my hopes up for these last two movies. I hate to see it end this way, but maybe a car crash was eventual. You know, maybe it was inevitable that we would come this way, because statistically, like Otto would say in Riders of Justice, things eventually just happen. But even if there's a little chance, a little tiny percentage of a chance that it's something else, it could be something else. So the same way that the man that the AI machine learning thing recognized was not the 100% match, was just 97 point something, maybe in that 3% chance that this movie might be good, there lies my heart and there lies my hope, Jesse, that we will bring Fast 10 back to the parking lot once again, safe and sound, with not a scratch.
The other thing that people are getting all confused about is that now Rita Moreno is in the cast
as Vin's mother. And I must tell you, first of all, it is great casting, because one, yeah, and also she has such mom vibes and also grandma vibes, because, you know, there's already Vin is already an uncle and a dad in those movies. So he's doubly dad bod. He's clearly dad bod in Fast 9. But I think it adds to something else in the great mythology of Dominic Toretto, which is his ethnic ambiguity. The whole cast is very ethnically diverse, and Dominic Toretto is, just like Vin Diesel, inexplicably Italian and Latin American at the same time, just like I am, right? Lanzetta, but from Brazil. Ooh, what is happening here? All these flavors in my mouth. It's like pineapple with pepperoni. Ah, come on. So, yeah, it's going to be great. It's going to be great. Rita Moreno, so glad.
And then the director is Louis Leterrier.
Yeah, fuck him.
Which translates as Louis the dog.
Louis the Terrier. But is he a bull terrier? Is he going to be able to what? Is he be able to domesticate the Vin Diesel? You will never know. We will never know. Well, we'll know once it hits theaters in 2030 or whatever. But really, it feels day after day, it feels like when Paul Walker died and was no longer able to park in front of high schools in Los Angeles and hit on underage girls, that movie franchise just went off. Just, it did not work without that libertarian, alleged ephebophile on the dance there. Like, man, like Vin Diesel is ruining himself. Like, I was a guy who used to chill to the video of Vin Diesel singing Rihanna's Stay, and now it just can't do it. I think about Justin Lin and going like, why didn't you stay? But at the same time, it's like, hey, you have to preserve yourself. This is a toxic relationship. Save yourself, Lin.
Oh, now tell me now, you know. Not really sure how I feel about it. Something in the way you move makes me feel like I can't live without you.
You brought things full circle, because Mads Mikkelsen was in a Rihanna video for Bitch Better Have My Money.
Which I always use that song to great song, love that song, but always use that song to recommend the original Bitch Better Have My Money by AMG, which is a song about male prostitution. Bitch, I don't charge by the inch, I charge by the foot. Don't think I'm lying? Here, take a look. Great lyrics, AMG. Rest in peace, or not. I don't know if he's alive, but his career is certainly dead. But listen to the original Bitch Better Have My Money by AMG, which is a great thing that rap artists do now and have been doing for a while, which is I'm gonna do a cover of a song, but it's actually just the chorus is the same, which people could learn while making reboots and remakes in Hollywood and having some original ideas. Because if you don't know and you're listening to this, the original 99 Problems is an Ice-T song about pimping hoes in Florida, and it's great. I got a bitch with a I got a bitch who burns my pager with priority calls, but I love them all. I love them. And it's great. Listen to the original 99 Problems by Ice-T. Listen to the original Bitch Better Have My Money by AMG. That's what I'm talking about.
it's crucial to mention that in the video for Bitch Better Have My Money, he's the bitch.
He's the bitch because, as Jay-Z says in 99 Problems, not in a hole in the sense of having a pussy, but a pussy having no goddamn sense.
He said, she acted when they met on the set. She acted as if we had known each other forever. And the coolest part, she had fake nails with my face on it for the video to remind her who the bitch is. She's
yes, like. Yes. Oh, I am a fan of fake nails. My girlfriend always buys like those glue-on fake nails. I think they're so. I would wear them if I could use my cell phone with those. But I think all of those. The quicker it is to get in and out of a costume, I think that's great. I love wigs and all kinds of clip-ons, and I think Rihanna's amazing. We almost had her baby born here. We had a campaign for that because her husband was coming over to do a concert here, and she was gonna fly with him, and she was very very pregnant by then, and so there was a possibility there. I remember people were very excited of, well, maybe she flies here, maybe the baby's born here, and Rihanna's son is Brazilian. Brazilian, oh, and then whatever Rihanna is plus Brazilian, even more exotic. Ah, but yeah, all the love in the world to Rihanna. Right, baby, come back to Brazil. You're great. We love you.
So, Gus, as always, wonderful to have you on the show. And I made sure that I carved out a little time to talk about the Fast Saga with you because you're one of the reigning world experts on the franchise.
Thank you. That's why I appreciate you, Jesse. You're a great host. You really tailor your episodes to your guests, and that's why I feel at home here. That's why I'm wearing Crocs and no socks. just a pleasure being here. I have nothing to plug because the things I do are in languages your people do not wish to understand. But if your listeners do wish to learn Portuguese by year's end, I just directed a true crime podcast about the assassination of a Brazilian spy during the military dictatorship. And there's a little bit of CIA hijinks and you know, just good old spy shit. And I think at least even if you don't speak Portuguese, you'll appreciate our original soundtrack that we did very much in the style of like 60 spy movies with a tropical little spice. And that's going to be really cool. So that's what I got.
And where can people find you on Twitter?
It's Goslan Zeta. It's probably written in the description of this episode. Follow me. I tweet a lot of dumb ass shit. I, you know, to please your audience, I have tweeted Morbius memes as well. It's Morbin time, maybe. And the latest one I did is because Valentine's Day in Brazil is coming up. And so I did a little Valentine's card you can use. It's there is an I in Morbius, but there's also an us, I and you. Isn't that lovely?
That is. That's beautiful, Gus. Oh, man. Thank you so much for coming back. And let's do it again sometime real soon.
Oh, whenever you want.
Before we go, just a reminder that we do have a Patreon, and patrons get access to additional bonus episodes every month. You can go to patreon.com/junkfilter to sign up now. Please like and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, and please follow us on Twitter @junkfilterpod. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken. Thank you so much for listening.